Submedia.
On July 6, 2018, the state quietly dropped its charges against the final 39 J-20 defendants, bringing the drawn-out legal saga to a stunning conclusion. To learn more about the case, we spoke with Michael Lowenthal, an anarchist organizer and academic insurgent stranded between Cincinnati, Ohio, and Washington, D.C., and a former J-20 co-defendant. What was your personal motivation for attending the J-20 protest? How did you hear about it? And did you have to travel far to attend?
I attended the protests coming from Cincinnati, Ohio. I came with my partner and our three children at the time. We came for the same reason I imagine most people came, which is that we have been alarmed and motivated by the rising fascistic tendencies, specifically with the presidency of Donald Trump. I've been lucky enough to attend numerous counter-inaugural activities over the past 15 or 20 years, but this one seemed particularly urgent, especially when we heard of the cooperation with right-wing militia and paramilitary groups such as the Three Percenters, who had announced their plans to attend, observe, infiltrate, and attempt to disrupt the counter-inaugural activities. So we attended we had planned to attend several days of activities, but because of my arrest on the first day, I wasn't able to attend much more than being in the prison and the courthouse. But we certainly attended with an obvious attempt to disrupt the inauguration, specifically because of the rising fascism of Trump. Most people, I think, experienced very similar things. So we were, eventually kettled on a corner of 12th and L Street in downtown D.C. And what seemingly is notable for me is the bravery and the spirit that people maintained during a very long period of just being, held outside on the corner. And so we were held from about 10 a.m. until well after nightfall, and people were very good about sharing food and sharing water and medical supplies and cigarettes or whatever else people needed to kind of keep their state of normal. And so the actual arrest was a very interesting time where people were sharing tactical advice and strategic advice. Of course, there's 1,001 people pontificating about what they think is going to happen, both legally, which was made much worse by the fact that the cops were very clearly in over their heads in the sense that they didn't know what they were doing. And so we were doing a lot of kind of interpreting their interpretation so we could hear the police discussing what they thought the charges were going to be or what they thought the next steps were going to be, and then we would communicate that. And of course, there's lots of rowdy singing and different things that create communities of care, from massage to, like I said, sharing food, helping people contact loved ones, get information to people. And then from there, it's the kind of normal way in which people are processed through the so-called criminal justice system. And I think that while we were treated very poorly, and while there are pending questions of sexual assault and people being denied basics like food and water, we have to recognize that we were given a far better treatment than most people who are just kind of pushed through the system received. And so, for example, as a vegan, I wasn't fed very well, but at the same time, because the spotlight was on them a bit more, we were at least given the appearance of food, white bread with circles of cucumbers on it. Eventually we were held, and we were held together, which again leads to people talking and sharing a lot, and then eventually processed, and then I was released later the night of the second day.
What were your specific charges stemming from the protests? How did it feel to be facing the prospect of decades behind bars? Was this widely understood among co-defendants as mainly being an intimidation tactic on the part of the state?
So we were initially each charged with one count of felony riot. While in the kettle, we were told we were going to be charged with one count of misdemeanor riot. We were eventually charged with one count of felony riot. 3 months later, while I was at an anarchist gathering in Mexico, I received an email from a comrade which informed me that the superseding indictment had been issued, and in that superseding indictment, we were given numerous additional charges. This includes felony riot, which was later reduced to misdemeanor riot once the state had to admit that there was no felony riot statute, conspiracy to riot, several counts of destruction of property, several counts of assault, and several counts of assault on an officer with a deadly weapon. The superseding indictment, to me, is very clearly a textbook case of overcharging for the sake of leveraging individuals to take a plea agreement. So the idea is, very simply, to charge people with far more crimes than you could possibly convict on, and then have them bargain out to the crimes which you can get a guilty plea on. One of the things which is really quite amazing with the large and diverse group of people who faced federal prosecution was the ability of people to act collectively and to resist this kind of knee-jerk reaction to take some sort of a plea bargain and to play into the state strategy of overcharging and then reduce the charges. And so the original charges were quite constrained, and I think that there's probably some people in the United States Attorney's Office who are kicking themselves for not maintaining that original strategy, because I think many people have commented that they probably could have gotten convictions on single counts, but not on this ridiculous slew of charges. So in the end, once the dust had settled and everyone had their charges posted, myself and most other co-defendants were facing what would amount to be a life sentence in prison as a 35-year-old individual being charged with a 65-year prison sentence would have amounted to a life prison sentence for myself and other people. I would say that the charges are designed to criminalize certain forms of dissent. They're designed to criminalize tactics and strategies. This seemed very clearly, once the state had laid its logic down, to be clearly a case looking at militant activism, specifically the use of public mass assemblies and specifically the use of black bloc tactics. The state sought to criminalize certain forms of organizing and sought to recode these as conspiracy. And this is really the hub of their strategy, was to take things such as providing medics or providing legal observers or providing food or water and recoding them and recasting those as conspiracy as opposed to normal elements of political organizing. One of the more absurd moments in the court proceedings was when the judge presented a piece of evidence which was basically a defendant communicating to his dog walker and saying, "Hey, I'm going to be out of town for 2, possibly 4 days. Can you please take care of my dog?" And the court used that email and used that correspondence to say that by this defendant telling his dog walker that he could be there for 4 instead of 2 days, that he was thus expecting to be arrested. And although that's a really absurd notion, it really highlights the state's logic, which is that preparatory arrangements that organizers were making were not for their safety or their security, but were in fact somehow a form of criminal conspiracy. And so this kind of highlighted that notion. And once we were able to push back on this, you know, the tagline, color coordination is not conspiracy, I think we were able to turn the tide a bit in terms of people understanding the case.
What were some of the most memorable parts of the court proceedings for you? Did your charges end up going to trial? Or were you just following along with one of the other trial blocks?
So my charges actually never went to trial. My lawyer felt that it was the best strategy to wait it out and to put us in the last trial block. So we selected, when we had the date selection, to have our trial in October. Now, as you know, the state, after failing to convict on the first set of trials, unceremoniously dropped about 100 cases. And after they dropped 100 cases, the state, in a sense, doubled down on what at the time was 59 of us who said that they had evidence that we were, you know, quote, most responsible for the violence and destruction that day, and that those 59 people were either so-called breakers, so-called organizers, or people acting with full knowledge of the use of black bloc tactics. After they failed to convict on the second trial block, additional charges were dropped, and the pool got even smaller, down to 39 defendants. So I have the displeasure of being in that last 39 defendant block, and the state continually asserting that even though we're getting a smaller and smaller group, they're going to continue prosecution. That being said, while I was in court many times for what felt like perfunctory appearances, I never went to trial because the case was dropped in July, and I was meant to go to trial in October. That being said, being in the court certainly had its effect on my family and our lives. Amongst other things, a perfunctory court date in February, I would say, prevented me from attending parts of my grandmother's funeral. We had petitioned the court to have an exemption in the sense that I did not need to be there that court date, simply to stand up and say, "Yes, I'm present." It seemed far more meaningful and just to attend a his funeral for a close family member, and although we issued an official order to the court denied that. being in court itself is meant to be part of the punishment. You know, we've said this numerous times that the longevity of the prosecution, the 18 months of court dates and 18 months of legal proceedings and 18 months of fear tactics and rhetoric is meant to be part of the punishment. Even if the state had never assumed that they would get mass convictions, they knew that by dragging organizers and by dragging participants through, you know, multi-year prosecutions, that they would drain them financially, they would affect them psychologically, they would, in attempt, defang people who had been invigorated by the spirit of resistance when Trump was inaugurated. I believe that's part of the strategy, very intentionally, regardless of the potential convictions.
What role did broader support and attention paid to your case play in terms of maintaining morale and helping with your and your co-defendants' material needs?
The support structure was really amazing from starting at the assembly at Logan Circle all the way down to the present when people are talking about things like civil suits. We could spend an entire day talking about the multiple ways in which the support networks helped. But again, you know, starting in the streets, we have legal observers, we have people helping with food. And when we arrived that day, there were people providing coffee and food and all sorts of things. Throughout the march itself, there's legal observers and people fulfilling a variety of other roles, like I said, like medical and legal observing. In the actual kettle itself, not only do we have the support network within those who are being penned in, but across the street there was, I guess, what we could call a rally of several hundred people who were asking for us to be let go, who were brutally attacked by cops and pushed back on away from us. While we were incarcerated, or at least in holding and being transferred, while we didn't see a lot of the supporters because we were in custody, we could hear them often outside. People knew that they were there. We were receiving word from lawyers and people who we were speaking with that there was lots and lots of people both packing the courtroom and outside for us. And I think that anyone who's ever been in police custody knows that it does something that's indescribable to know that once you are out, that there's people waiting for you. I think there's often a fear, especially of people who are being released at night in a city that they don't know, that they're going to be all alone. But it was precisely the opposite of that. I mean, when we eventually got out of the courthouse, I was released around, I'm going to say 10 o'clock at night. It was quite dark. There were hundreds of people there cheering and providing food and anything people needed for their material needs. And that's just the on-the-ground support, right? It's not even speaking to a wider support network, providing people with legal strategy, with funds for the legal defense, with housing so that they can attend court, with psychological and mental and other forms of mental health care, with creating what we're trying to do, which is a prefigurative community of care, right? To show support networks in the current, which resemble the types of communities we're trying to create. And most of those forms of support are behind the scenes, right? Most of those we don't see. And I think that's really important to acknowledge that there's thousands of hours that go into creating these caring communities that are often unacknowledged and largely unseen. And this is people, again, cooking food and helping book housing and helping drive people to pick up their property and all those sorts of things.
What was your role in the J20 legal defense? How did this case compare to other cases you've been involved with in the past?
So I helped the J20 legal defense in a variety of different ways. I think when we do this, we all try to play to our strengths. One of the things I was happy to help with was the kind of oppositional research to counter some of the arguments being made about the way in which this specific tactic was used in the streets. In other words, one of the things I was trying to do was to counter the pushback that people dressing the same, people acting to ensure one another's safety, was tantamount to criminal conspiracy. I've had a lot of experience observing and studying radical social movements, many of which use tactics that look very similar to this. And what I was able to do was to help push back a bit on this narrative. I would say that most of the work I was doing was, in a sense, on a narrative and rhetorical level, right? Helping media create sound bites and creating media that was able to frame our movement in a way which was not in this criminal conspiracy mind. So again, I was able to help with a lot of the media work. I gave a bunch of interviews. We did a lot of off-the-record background for reporters. So for example, if a reporter wants to do something on the case, one of the things that we feel is very important and one of the things which I was able to do was to explain how this case fits into a larger context, right? How does the J20 case fit into the criminalization of dissent? How does the prosecution fit into what we've seen in the past 2 years where the Trump administration has recast certain forms of political assembly as riots and used that re-identification as a riot as a way to further criminalize mass assemblies? If we want to talk about specifics, when the state postured that they were going to use a so-called black bloc expert, first an undercover and later by an FBI agent, we were able to push back a lot on the sort of credentials that person had, as well as what they claimed to be expert knowledge. I teach social movement theory. I teach about repression. I'm able to use some of those academic credentialing to challenge the FBI, and in this case, the FBI's fabrication of certain historical realities. One of the more interesting times was when, you know, the FBI asserted that one of the reasons their expert was deemed an expert was their familiarity with Mark Bray's book on anti-fascists. And when the FBI agent quoted Mark's book, Mark quickly went into the media and said, you know, that's not what I wrote, and that's not what the history says, so you can't use my words to do that. We have strong reason to believe that the FBI, or rather the U.S. Attorney's Office, was using my work in a very similar way, and I've written a fair bit on anarchist movements. And so some of the work I was trying to do was to not allow the state to criminalize that knowledge we've produced. In addition, we were, again, doing some other forms of support. We do a lot of collective writing for statements and media, as well as direct organizing to meet people's basic material needs. So fundraising, finding people housing, and things like that.
What were some of the challenges involved in coordinating a legal defense involving so many co-accused?
There's a lot of challenges, from interpersonal disagreements to the sort of problems you get when you take 200 somewhat random people and put them in a situation of high pressure. I was able to help with some of the conflict mediation, which comes up. I think one of the challenges we faced was pushing back on the state's good protester, bad protester dichotomy. So very early on, it became clear that the state had taken the 230 people and broken them up into categories. They even gave these categories numbers and names. And it seemed to be that the categories were meant to show a continuum of culpability. And with this continuum from people who the state claimed to have tons of evidence on to people who were, you know, again, to use their language, just there for the demonstration, is very challenging because the tendency is for people who feel less accused to cooperate in order to put pressure on those who are more accused. We were able to really resist this very well. And while I believe 17 people out of 230 would eventually take plea bargains to various degrees, most of those were people with pretty particular scenarios, and most of them were people who were under a certain age and did that because of a youth abatement. And so when we have so many people with so many diverse interests and so many diverse needs, there's always going to be conflict. But I think that having seen large collective defenses before, this was surprisingly smooth. And you know, outside of a couple individuals who took plea bargains, you know, we really were able to work as a group very effectively.
Can you give a brief explanation of conspiracy law and how it was applied in this case? What are some of the benefits and drawbacks of prosecuting conspiracy charges from the state attorney's perspective?
Sure. Conspiracy law is a really tricky thing used in this case in a very specific and strategic way. What conspiracy law basically says is that anyone who's convicted of or can be found liable for any particular crime, in this case the criminal conspiracy, is thus responsible for all the crimes that stem from that. The state asserted in a rather untraditional way that the conspiracy itself can be spontaneous. In other words, if two people are walking by a store and they say, hey, that store looks unlocked, let's go rob it, that a conspiracy is actually derived in that moment. So the state argued that during the J20 actions, that people conspired in the streets. They conspired by wearing the same clothes. They conspired by chanting the same chants, which is such an absurd notion, it doesn't even require rebuttal. That people conspired by bringing medics, that people conspired by bringing lawyers. But again, what this is trying to do is to recast the ways in which political organizing occurs with criminal conspiracy. We've seen this in the past during some of the Green Scare cases where conspiracy was brought up. We've seen this where forms of political assembly are actually recast as racketeering. The way in which it's used in a case like this is that if you can get a jury to convict on the conspiracy count, then all of the subsequent charges are thus rendered more legitimate. And so, for example, if you can say that, you know, let me say it this way, the state would consistently assert that defendant A did not assault anyone, nor did they break any windows. But by being present at an assembly, they have thus conspired to facilitate others to break windows and to carry out assault. So the use of conspiracy allows the state to cast a very wide net and to take the criminal liability and to spread it across everyone. That simply by being present, that individual is aiding and abetting, which is in itself a separate charge, the crimes that come from it. Now, one of the interesting kind of reversals of this is that when the state lost their ability to argue criminal conspiracy, because they were found to have been concealing evidence and committing what's called a Brady violation, when they lost the ability to prosecute under the conspiracy, one of the reasons that they likely dropped the rest of the charges is that they would have lost the ability to charge the subsequent crimes. The legal term, or the legal way it's described, is fruit of the poison tree. The idea is that if the original charge, in this case conspiracy, is invalidated, that the assault and property destruction charges that individuals would have conspired to do are thus not able to be proven. And so conspiracy is both a very powerful tool that the state can use because it's overly broad and very difficult to challenge, and it's something that's very difficult for defendants to push back on because conspiracy basically becomes akin to organizing. If conspiracy is getting together to plan a crime and they're arguing that organizing is criminal, then all forms of organizing become conspiracy. And this is something that we have to push back on very, very strongly, because if not, we run the risk of taking all forms of public organizing and having it recast in this felonious and criminalized light.
Washington, D.C. has an established history dating back to the anti-globalization era of successful legal challenges to instances of excessive police brutality, particularly as it relates to crowd control situations. How did this affect the legal strategy and the political environment that this case took place in?
The history of mass arrests in D.C. created, I think, both a false sense of security for people in the streets, as well as some confusion about our legal strategy. When we were in the kettle, many of us who had been to previous mass assemblies in D.C. and indeed organized mass assemblies in D.C. and had been arrested at those mass assemblies were, in a sense, giving false advice and giving false sense of security. So, for example, there was lots of people saying, don't worry, all they're going to do is give you what's called a post and forfeit. It's basically a civil citation. You'll admit that you were, you know, unlawfully assembling or incommoding, which basically means refusing to leave, and that you'll be given this ticket. You'll post your bond of $100 or whatever, and you'll leave, and you'll forfeit your right to contest these charges, and you'll move on with your life. That's the way that most mass assemblies had been treated in the past. The Pershing Park arrests, the Freedom Plaza arrests, again, at the height of the anti-globalization movement. And so I think many of us thought, if it had a sense of safety, right, I think people would have scoffed at the idea on January 19th of there being a mass arrest of this nature in D.C. Now, that being said, there's a distinction that needs to be made between police procedure and policy and law. After the mass arrests in 2004, the Metropolitan Police Department, the D.C. Police, changed their standard operating procedures, which basically meant that prior to any future mass arrests, the state had to let people know that they had an option to leave. In short, they would surround the demonstration, they'd use amplification and say, you know, you have 5 minutes to leave, you'll be arrested. 2 minutes later, you have 4 minutes to leave, you'll be arrested, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is the standard operating procedure that the police had established after 2004. And this is, of course, because of lawsuits. Because we knew this to be the reality, many people were listening for those amplified warnings, and prior to those amplified warnings, assumed that they had some degree of liberty in terms of being able to leave. So I think that the history of mass arrests in D.C. gave us really a false sense of how the state was going to proceed. Certainly, the J-20 arrest and prosecution was out of character for the way in which these had been treated in the past. And I think many people were quick to say that this is the result of Donald Trump and his influence, but I think we need to look much broader at the way in which the prosecution of demonstrators has changed in the past few years, both in the final years of the Obama administration as well as the early years of the Trump administration. You know, I've said this many times, but we can look at the anti-protest laws that were passed and introduced in January and February of 2017, many of which came at the tail end of the Obama administration. But many of these laws sought to recriminalize certain forms of protests, such as the wearing of masks or assembling or blocking critical infrastructure or blocking roads. So we can see that while we can learn a lot from the history of the ways in which these demonstrations were treated in the past, there's also a lot which is deceptive. And the state is a smart and adaptive entity, and it's learning, right? It has long institutional memory. It has a great ability to kind of do trial and error. And so I think that the J20 prosecutions was an attempt by the state to try something new, to say, we tried this in 2004, we got sued, we had to change the way we do it, let's try something different. And I think that this case was reflective of that kind of experimental nature of the way in which the state is learning how to deal with new forms of resistance.
Can you describe the Project Veritas video that ultimately factors so heavily into the outcome of the case? What implications can be drawn from the fact that the U.S. Justice Department was willing to cooperate with a discredited far-right news outlet to attempt to prosecute the J20 protesters?
The use of the Project Veritas video, as well as the tacit acceptance of aid from right-wing nationalist militias such as the Three Percenters, I think represents a very critical point which we need to focus on. The role of the particular video is used to prove criminal conspiracy. Again, members of Project Veritas clandestinely took video at a public planning meeting and then introduced that as evidence of criminal conspiracy. I wasn't at that meeting. I can't speak to what went on there outside of what I saw in the video. But the fact that the United States Attorney's Office was willing and I would say eager to accept evidence from a discredited far-right organization, which Donald Trump has direct financial contributions to me is quite troubling. It's troubling that they saw that as neutral. It's troubling that they saw that as legally viable. It's troubling that they concealed so much of that evidence that it landed them this Brady violation. I think that what we see here is, again, both a tacit acceptance of and an embracing of cooperation between far-right groups and the federal government. Seeing Three Percenters, you know, announcing their intent to spy on and assist police in a demonstration should be something that the state pushes back on and says, you know what, we don't need vigilantes, right? The state, so if we look at, for example, Arizona, the federal government and the Customs and Border, you know, it continually says we don't want the help of so-called militiamen, you know, the Minutemen, the people who are self-appointed vigilantes to protect the southern U.S. border. I think that many of us expected to see something similar when Project Veritas or the Three Percenters or the Oath Keepers, which was very, very prominent in some of these demonstrations, decided to help the government in prosecuting this case. I think everyone maybe, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of silly that we assumed this, but that the federal government would not accept that. But clearly the government was very willing to take cooperation from this. And I think that when we have far-right media and far-right, you know, so-called investigative groups collaborating with the federal government, that shows a degree of, to use their term, conspiracy, which is really quite problematic and quite troubling. And instead of pushing back on these groups and saying, you know what, you've been discredited for your attacks against Planned Parenthood, you've been discredited for your attacks against the Me Too movement, you've been discredited time and time again, you know, maybe we don't want to take your footage, especially footage that you've edited, especially footage that you've admitted to editing, and especially footage that you took at a public event without knowledge of the participants. These should have been things the government said, thanks, but no thanks. But instead, they opened their arms, they took this footage in, and they used it against demonstrators. And we can say that because of their use of this footage, the entire case collapsed, so maybe they got what they were, you know, deserving.
Can you speak to the precedents, whether legal or political, that were set by this case? How might it affect future cases of mass arrests at large protests in the United States?
So for me, the J20 case really is important for precisely this reason, for the precedents that it sets and for how it explains what has gone on in this country in the past couple years. You know, I've spoken before about you know, terrorization. A lot of the work I was looking at, you know, after 9/11, how we saw a rhetorical shift and a discursive shift, right? A shift in discourse and a shift in rhetoric between activism and terrorism, how those were equated in the minds of the court and how those were equated in the minds of prosecutions like the FBI. What we saw in the last 2 years, so again, not starting with Trump, but starting with demonstrations from the Black Lives Matter movement and demonstrations against the Dakota Access Pipeline, was a rapid increase in felony prosecutions, targeting demonstrators for crimes which were already illegal. So people would block a highway. Normally they would be charged with unlawful assembly or obstructing, blocking a road. And what we see starting in July of 2016 is that some of these individuals were actually charged with felonies. So I've called this, and others have likely called this felonization, the same way you say terrorization. But we see the felonization of a lot of these demonstrations starting around the time of Standing Rock. We see Standing Rock organizers being charged this way. We see the Glo Merriweather case being charged this way. We saw the prosecution of Red Fawn at Standing Rock being charged this way. And so what we notice is a sharp increase in the use of felony prosecutions for crimes, which or so-called crimes, which would have prior been prosecuted as misdemeanors. In conjunction with this, what we see is that many forms of public assembly are actually recast as riots. Now again, in DC, this dates back to 1968 when the DC Riot Act was passed. And the DC Riot Act, in its heart, is a racist law. It's a law that says that African Americans demonstrating in Washington, D.C. after the assassination of King are rioters and not demonstrators, and that what separates a rioter from a demonstrator is politics. So if you're apolitical, if you have no politics, you're a rioter, and if you have politics, it's a demonstration. So the D.C. Riot Act in itself has a racist logic where in order to be a riot, an individual has to be deemed apolitical. Now if you pause for a second, this is slightly paradoxical because it would be impossible to argue on any level that the J20 assembly was apolitical. However, people are being charged under this racist riot law. And so we can see these types of laws, right, what we can call the riotization. There's laws passed in Georgia, Virginia, Missouri, and a number of other states where actual assemblies, if they involve a threat, a quote, grievous threat to property is usually the term, that is thus a riot. Now, again, this is very problematic because what it does is it challenges people on both a psychological and a linguistic level, right? It changes what that term actually means. If every time groups of people get together and present a risk to property, which arguably every sports rally and every political rally in itself does, then every form of political assembly is a riot, right? When everything's a riot, nothing's a riot, right? This is something that people said, you know, during the terrorization after 9/11. If everything people do is domestic terrorism, then that word becomes meaningless. And so one of the precedents that we can see with the J20 prosecutions is that it becomes a viable strategy to just cast a wide net, to charge people as viciously as possible, to lock them up in prosecutions for several years, and if you get convictions, great. And if you don't, you've just taken people out of action for 2 years and cost them millions of dollars. And so I think the precedent for the way in which felonization and the way in which riotization is occurring is very, very clear. If we look at this on a theoretical level, which is where I tend to take it, we can say that the state kind of waxes and wanes, kind of shifts in the way in which it deals with resistance and repression. There are eras in which the state moves back to what we would call sovereign power, when, again, we want to display the brutality of state power, and there's other times where that wants to retreat, where the state would rather get people to self-police, get people to be fearful and inactive. The J20 case represents a very clear example of the former, a very clear example of the state holding up the metaphorical head at the guillotine and saying, this is what happens when you resist. You know, it seems clear to all of us in the fray of it that the brutality and the severity of both the arrest and the prosecution at J20 was a shot across the bow by the Trump administration to say, this is what happens when people resist, right? This is what happens when you try to block my Muslim ban. This is what happens when you try to block putting kids separating kids from parents in ICE detention facilities. You know, it was the state's attempt to say, this is what happens when you resist. Here's 230 people, we're gonna put them in prison for life. This is what happens when you break the law. This is what happens when you come out and resist in this way. So the precedent legally is very meaningless. The precedent psychologically and strategically and in the minds of the media is extremely strong. And that's really where I think we have to fight. Certainly we have to fight them in the streets. Certainly we have to fight them in the courtroom. Certainly we have to fight them, you know, in the academy. But I think what we really have to do is engage in this discourse, in this discursive battle. Because what this is the state's ability to take, or the state's attempt to take what we're doing and to call it something else. To look at this red fruit that is sweet and call it a banana, right? And I think that this is really problematic for us. If we're not able to name what we're doing, if we give that ability back to the state, where the state is able to tell us what we're doing and what it's called, and every time people gather in the streets, they're rioting, that really creates both a disincentive for many people to attend, as well as confusion for people who are passively consuming this, people who are trying to engage in some sort of back and forth, and to show them the beauty of our vision and the vile nature of what our opponent's proposing. So I think the precedent legally is challenging, the precedent psychologically and discursively and rhetorically is really challenging, and I think that one of the things we're able to show is the strength and the beauty of collective action and the ability of individuals to resist when needed.
What lessons did you learn from this whole process? Are there things you would have done differently in hindsight? Or things that you think other people who find themselves in similar situations would do well to learn from?
I think one of the most important things we can do is to create a culture of both opacity and resiliency, right? To create a culture which is both opaque to external authorities, in this case the police, and resilient to police pressure. And so by creating an opaque culture, I mean creating a normative culture in which we do not cooperate with police, we do not answer questions, we do not appear in federal grand juries, we do not accept plea bargains that incriminate others, we do not consent to searches. And creating these as practices which are just the norm allows us to act collectively in a way that protects the most vulnerable. During the J20 prosecution, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, points of unity and people agreeing to certain points of unity. And in a sense, I'd like us as a movement and the culture within our movement to move beyond that, where when people are arrested, when people are in custody, they presume that already there's going to be mass defense, there's going to be collective defense, there's going to be non-cooperation with plea agreements, there's going to be non-cooperation with federal grand juries. We hear now about a number of grand juries being organized, not necessarily in relation to this case, but in relation to the wider anti-fascist and anti-capitalist organizing that's increased in the last 2 years. And oftentimes the conversation is, will people participate? Will people cooperate? And I'd like to get us to a cultural point where we assume non-cooperation as the standard. Now, that's what I kind of mean by opacity. But we also have to talk about creating communities which are resilient, communities which are able to function under prosecution, communities which are able to support one another when people are facing difficult times. Oftentimes, the purpose of these prosecutions is to sap people's resources, to take them out of activity, and to remind them of the potentiality for punishment. Right? In the time of sovereigns and kings, what we would do is we'd bring the person who attempted to violate the king's sovereignty into the middle of the town square, and they would, you know, chop their head off with the guillotine and put their head on a spike and say, you know, this is what happens when you transgress authority. And these public trials, these public arrests and prosecutions are precisely that. They're an attempt by the state to show this is what happens when you resist. And the way we can push back on that is remaining resilient by acting bravely, by acting fiercely, by acting with courage in these times when the state is designed to prevent us from being active, to, again, defang us, to quiet us, to factionalize us, to cause infighting, to cause people to work against each other. And so in these times of increased prosecution, of increased pressure, it's all the more important for people to act with a sincere sense of solidarity and bravery in times when that threatens their physical safety, their material conditions, and whatnot. I think this is a true test case, and I think it's very clear that we rose above that and that people were able to act collectively in a time when the state was doing all it could do to kind of split us apart and pit, you know, so-called good protester against bad protester, against those of us who are, quote, just there, to those of us who are, quote, breaking things. And so I think that that really is an example of solidarity in action and a real true strength of our collective abilities.